Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Nazir, very, very busy week. We've obviously got the ongoing investigation into the murder of Olivia Pratt Corbell. In fact, it's had a direct impact. I was due to meet Merseyside Police at their major crime team next week in relation to a big case that I'm working on. They've unfortunately had to cancel. And the reason being, when I've spoken to them, is that they are simply inundated. They have absolutely been swamped from major crime team and across the whole of Merseyside investigators to tackle this massive problem.
Absolutely.
It is still ongoing now. And of course, the parent came out the other day and pleaded.
A number of people have been arrested. They've been bailed. I mean, I know what's going on in the background. I mean, one can suspect, based on what we know, is that they have prime suspects.
Yeah.
But it's not enough to have prime suspects. You've got to have the
evidence. They know who's done it. This is Butler. Yeah. They know who's done it. The bottom line is that at the present moment in time, they need the evidence.
And so while people may be, you know, upset that people have been bailed, it's better to get it right at this stage for the unlike the case unfolding. And as you said, Merseyside are throwing everything at this, quite rightly so. It was the most horrific crime. It is the most horrific crime, and they've been inundated, as you say, with lots of information and evidence from the community. All of that has to be sifted. All the CCTV, all the digital evidence, etc., has to be sifted. So I'm still confident, as we all are, that the other day people will be prosecuted for this terrible crime. People just need to be take their time. It needs to get it right.
And actually, Merseyside Police, when we are very critical of some police forces, I have to say, and I've got a good relationship with Merseyside Police, they are very good. There's some very, very good senior officers there, and they are well led.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, and Andy Crook is the current Inspector of Constabulary, was a Merseyside Chief Constable. Bernard Hogan Howe was a Merseyside Chief Constable. They've been well led by very, very formidable characters. But as we've said, this is such a high-profile crime that has touched everybody. They have made the right judgment, i.e. let's get everybody on this case. Of course, it's really good that so many people from Liverpool and Merseyside have provided them with evidence and information. We encourage more people to do so.
Brilliant. Well, our thoughts remain with Olivia and her family and friends. Let's move on to talk about racism in justice. Nazir, this is something that you've spent an awful lot of time on recently. It's something that goes to the heart of what we talk about very often. Just talk to me about what research you've been doing.
Well, I have the good fortune of publishing my next book.
And
I've actually got my first hard copy of it. It comes out the day before we broadcast this, and it's called The Race to the Top. And what I've done over the last year or so is I haven't just focused on criminal justice. It stems from a conversation I had with somebody called Theresa May. Remember her?
She said to me,
Nazir, you're the chief, at that time I was chief executive of the police commissioner. You're the chief executive of the police commissioner. You've been the chief prosecutor. How can there really be racism? You know, look at what you've achieved. I said, have you got 10 minutes? But it really struck me was that people seem to think that if people can reach the heights and we've got, three cabinet ministers at the top level, that if you're at that level, suddenly racism disappears, that you've got some kind of vaccine or some kind of medication that prevents it from affecting you. The reality, of course, is that I've experienced it all of my life, Mark, and continue to. And I have no doubt whatsoever that other leaders have done. And so I've interviewed about 100 plus leaders across all sectors of society, health, education, sport, arts and culture, et cetera, et cetera. Really, people you will know, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, tried to explain to me how religion is dealing with racism. But I felt that because what we talk about is criminal justice, there's a whole chapter on criminal justice. And what I've done is I've interviewed people, judges. The judges, of course, can't speak on the record. So I've anonymized them as best as I possibly can. I've interviewed senior police officers, senior prosecutors, etc., and get their sense of where we are in the world. And unfortunately, we are still in a pretty dark place. Give you one example. The president of the Law Society is a woman called I. Stephanie Boyce. And she, she's the first black woman president of the Law Society in its 150-year history. And you would imagine, look at what I've achieved, you know. And then she reels off example after example of how she's been treated. One which is quite telling, really. It may not seem like much, but you know, every year there's more than once a year there's something called an admission ceremony where new lawyers are admitted to become solicitors, and she as president has to attend this reception where they all are. And she says that she was there, all booted and suited, looking the part. And pretty much every time that she reached out to shake somebody's hand, a family member's hand or something, they just left it hanging. And then she had to say, "I'm president of the Law Society," before they would grab it, you know? And that's the kind of example that people just don't understand. I can tell you without any doubt in my mind that any person of color that listens to that story will recognize that. You know, that somehow you have to explain your position before they treat you with more respect than they would otherwise. And that is, so the book does that, but given what we focus on, and you mentioned an instance yesterday or the day before yesterday, if you recall, there was another shooting of an unarmed black man in London, Chris Cabba. There was a report 2 days ago that showed that we talked about Child Q, the strip search. Yes. Earlier this year. Well, there's a report from the Freedom of Information Request that found that there had been 14 strip searches of children in London, and 11 of them were black women, or black girls.
And that's very interesting. So, I mean, let's go back slightly. Of course, it came very much to the forefront of the public's view and knowledge when we had the McPherson report,
which
was very, very clear, setting out that in the opinion of the author that there was institutional racism.
But the police accepted. The police accepted back in 1999, 2000, and they said they would do something about it. And this is the problem, I think, is what do you do about it? And a lot of people seem to always think of activity as being progress. Doing stuff doesn't mean that you're making progress, you know? And so you will have had, in the last 20 years, you'll have had equality diversity officers, you'll have had race equality action plans, you'll have had all manner of documents and meetings. But the experience remains. We've only had one black chief constable, Mike Fuller, who I think you know, in Kent, and that was 12, 13 years ago. Every year there are at least another 10 chief constables appointed because of retirements, and we still have only had one. And, that irks because I know the talent that exists at that level from black and minority communities, but for some reason they can't be trusted with a top job. And that, of course, filters down through the culture of the organization. So, when we talked about Child Q, we were astonished at what happened there. We're regularly astonished at how there seems to be a lack of supervision and a lack of monitoring and stop and search, as we know, 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched if you're a black person. And yet, they hardly find any knives from stops and search. Intelligence is poor.
And that's very interesting. And I think there's, out of the McPherson report, of course, there was the point raised that there was institutional racism, was accepted by the police. But there is also this other area, which is implicit racial bias. Yeah. Now, I find that really interesting because basically what that's saying is that whilst there are people out there, the white community, who would turn around and say, well, actually, do you know what? I'm not racist. I've got friends who are from the black Asian community. I work with them all the time. What implied that implied aspect of racial bias is basically saying, well, whilst openly you're saying that, internally there is an issue. So you will mix more with white people. Yeah. You will see black people as those people who get into trouble, who carry weapons. It's an implied, and actually this is where the challenge is, because it's much deeper. It's not something that surfaces necessarily.
It's assumptions people make. We all make assumptions, don't we, through life. And so those assumptions are based on prejudices, and they're based on life experiences. They're also based on the company you keep. So you're absolutely spot on. If the only people you ever meet are people who are like you, then everybody else will be different. And therefore, you may not necessarily know how to react in those circumstances. Another example, which is in the book, but it's, I'll share with you. You probably remember somebody called Ali Desai.
I know Ali Desai because I did an investigation on Ali Desai when he was under absolute scrutiny by the Metropolitan Police in relation to his behaviour.
Ali, as you know, and listeners
he's
as well,
he's
know,
a character.
Well, he was a chief. He was chief superintendent. He was of Persian origin, Iranian origin, and he was suspected of corrupt behaviour. And there was a very extensive, I think, £1 million investigation, internal investigation,
very detailed,
which found nothing. And he ended up getting compensation from the Met for that. So anyway, so then he then became chief superintendent for Hounslow Borough in West London, and I was the chief prosecutor for London at that time. And somebody came up to me at a social event. Some guy comes up to me and says, "There's Ali Desai. There's a guy going around saying he's Ali Desai, taking money from people in the community, and he's asked me if I don't pay up, I will be." Arrested, and accused of crimes. I said, really? Okay. Do you know what? This is pre-internet, or this is, pre-before Google, et cetera, et cetera. So I said, do you know what he looks like? And he described this guy. I said, that's nothing like him, right? So clearly there was an impersonator out there. So I then went back to the police, and I spoke to the borough commander for Hounslow, Ali Desai. And I said, Ali, there's somebody impersonating you. And Ali said, as rightly as he should do, don't talk to me about this. Talk to my chief of staff, right? So I then addressed told the chief of staff everything. Chief of staff said, right, okay. I left it with them. They carried out a sting investigation. So they set up a meeting between this community member and the person impersonating him, and he was arrested. And he'd been, in effect, extorting money from a lot of people claiming to be Ali Desai. And Ali was given, that guy was given 6 years in prison. So it was quite a big deal. And it stemmed from that one conversation in a social event. But then this is the thing I really wasn't prepared for. I then got a phone call from the assistant commissioner at the Met, John Yates, remember him?
Yes.
John said, Nazir, I just have to let you know that we actually investigated you too. I said, what? He said, because you told Ali that there was an impersonator, we decided to investigate that. I said, oh, well, two brown people talked about something, and we're both can be committing crime, are we? He goes, no, the decision was taken by some senior officer. I regret that we had to do that. I apologize. Nothing was obviously found. You did everything right. I said, I was literally... you won't believe how angry I was. And Johnny Yates ended up sending me a letter of apology from the Met for that. But that, again, is something that people of color will recognize, is that when we are talking to each other, we're conspiring. And it's the thing that you mentioned about bias and assumptions. You wouldn't think that if two white people, if you, Martin, and Mark, our producer, were chatting in a bar or in a restaurant, nobody would be thinking, oh, they're conspiring to do something. But unfortunately, the bias is so ingrained in our society that two brown people or two black people talking.
But let me take that to another level, because I did an investigation in relation to this, and I got hold of all the paperwork that the Metropolitan Police had. They held top secret meetings with very senior officers at a location to discuss Ali Desai because of the seniority of Ali. But actually, one of their targets as part of that, and it may well be that your name appears in the paperwork that I have, but one of the names that was in there was Tariq Ghafur.
Yeah,
and assistant commissioner. The assistant commissioner. And do you know why Tariq was in there? Because Tariq and Ali Desai used to speak. And so as a direct result of that, Tariq himself
was investigated.
Got a code name. He got a code name as part of this operation, and he was considered. And that was simply because they were communicating. So what you ended up having is a racial bias, because Ali Desai was being investigated.
Yeah.
And because of the other people he was talking to, who ended up also being from ethnic minority, Asian, they went after Tariq Ghafur.
I didn't know that. It's staggering, isn't it? We're just in a position where we can't even talk to each other. And in this case, the conversation I had with him ultimately led to somebody being convicted and sent to jail for 6 years, and protecting the community. But even in that scenario, I end up under suspicion. Tariq under Ghafur, assistant commissioner under suspicion. Ali Desai, at the end of the day, he was ultimately convicted of perverting the course of justice in relation to something completely different. You all know that. We all know that. So there was, but the point is, your point about inherent bias. People make assumptions and prejudices. The number of times I've been in a room, I remember going into a room and I was pretty much the only non-white person in a very senior room at the Home Office. and some other brown person walks in. I felt, oh my God, thank God for that. And he was doing the PowerPoint presentation. He was the IT guy, you know. And I, even I made assumptions, but I, it was, you know, from a good place. I thought, thank God, there's some other senior color, person of color will be in this meeting, and I'll feel, you know, some strength in numbers, so to speak. But we all make assumptions that based on our experiences, and that, you know, when you are in a position of power, whether you're a police, whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a judge, all those kinds of areas, any other area, those assumptions can be dangerous, can't they? You know, you end up making, I mean, one funny one was not funny, I guess, but I remember there was a district judge in a magistrate's court, and there was a trial. There wasn't a trial. There was a case involving somebody was attacked. And the judge said, I've got time this afternoon. We'll have the trial this afternoon. Go and get the witness, Miss Patel, to come. And the prosecutor on my behalf said, we can't fix a trial at 15 minutes notice. You know, he goes, well, he's in custody. She just needs to come and say her story. And he goes, well, Miss Patel might be really busy. And then this is what the district judge said. District judge then said, Miss Patel, how could she possibly be busy? Well, probably running a shop, right? Dr. Patel, as she turned out to be, wasn't running a shop. So just imagine the kinds of, if he thinks that way, imagine what he's doing in terms of decision. At the end of the day, I got him struck off, by the way. So we complained about him, and the judiciary struck him off. And he was also, this is even crazier, apart from being a magistrate's court judge, he was also an immigration judge. Right, so people making assumptions and biases, you know, they have consequences.
Yeah.
Now, and I think so. We need to recognize that it's not just one person and you know, get over it. A number of times people said to me, "Oh, just get over it." You know,
right. Let me look at the flip side, Nazir. So we've got a situation where more recently we had the grooming gangs, and we had the grooming gangs, the Asian, the Pakistani origin. And one of the things that came out of that was the fear of the police to be involving themselves in that community. So you've gone from one extreme to the other.
And the other, I mean, as you know, I dealt with those cases. And you know, the problem with that, one of the big problems with that, Mark, is that they made assumptions. They could have actually spoken to senior leaders in the community who had said, get these fuckers, excuse my language.
Yeah.
You know, they're damaging our confidence in our community. They are criminals. They're ultimately making people safe. They made an assumption that some people in the community would be upset about this, rather than thinking, can we talk to them about the fact we've got these allegations out there? And then they would have realized very quickly, as I did, that they're actually 99.9% of the community are law-abiding. They want these people out of the system. Mm. They want these people imprisoned. So 100%, people made the people, generally, unfortunately, they were white people, made assumptions that the community, there'll be community tension or whatever it may be. None of that was borne out by the facts. But at the end of the day, hundreds of young girls and children were harmed because they didn't have those proper conversations.
Do you think the communities now, I mean, there's a lot of work happened over the past 20 years, really, around community relationships and working with ethnic communities.
Yeah.
Do you think we've moved forward in a very positive way where we are now? I mean, obviously, one of the biggest problems we've got is community policing is struggling to exist at the moment.
That's the point, isn't it, Mark? I mean, massive progress was being made when you had safer neighbourhood teams or the equivalent around the country. You as your neighbors knew who your local police officer was. There was usually a police station nearby, you know, that kind of stuff. We've lost 600 police stations in the last 10 years. You know, they've closed them down. There's one in the northwest of England that was bought by an organized crime gang team. And they run it as a pizza restaurant with extra toppings. Right. And you know, they buy these things as a badge of honor. So the point is, you don't know who your local police officer is anymore. You don't even have a local police station. Yeah. Policing has been absolutely reduced by numbers, but also by experience. And so, we know that works. We know when you have a strong relationship with your local police division and your local neighborhood team, that you get intelligence, that you get support, that you know people are prepared to look out for each other, and ultimately crime reduces. Because we haven't got any of that, crime is going up. Violent crime is definitely going up. The police are seen as not being effective in tackling burglary and issues like that. So we're in a really bad place, and we've talked about this before, that trust is not there, trust comes from strong relationships. And because you're not there, the police aren't able to be there, those relationships don't exist.
I'd be interested to talk about the criminal justice system and judges. You alluded to the fact you've interviewed a few judges. How is it perceived, do you think, within the criminal justice system? So when a black or ethnic minority person comes into the court system, do you think they are predisposed to be found guilty, more so than a white person? How do you think that sits also with juries?
Well, I'll talk about juries in a moment. The research, again, there's research out there that says if you're a black person, you're more likely to be suspected, you're more likely to be searched, you're more likely to be arrested, you're more, on the same evidence as a white person, you're more likely to be charged, you're more likely to be convicted, and you're more likely to be sentenced to jail on the same evidence as a white person. So, you know, that the research is already out there. And it's, again, it's very subtle. I don't imagine there's any judge out there that goes, right, you're black, 6 months. You know, it doesn't work that way.
But isn't that the point? The implicit racial bias that could sit across the judges, and by and large, judges, and we've talked about judges, they are very much from the same ilk. Yeah, they all come from the same community or the same type of university things.
Private
so does
schools,
that mean, private school, does that mean that actually we've got implied racial bias sitting from the judges?
We've got to monitor it. And we don't have the access to monitor that. I'll give you another example, one I dealt with myself a long time ago now. I'm dealing with the bail application of, you know, people will understand, you know, somebody's arrested overnight, they turn up in court and there's a decision that's made about bail, whether they can be released or not, pending a trial. And I'm busy. About 100 of these cases have come in, so I'm not looking behind me at who's in the dock. And one comes up, and this guy's got no previous convictions, and it's not relatively serious. So I say to the judge, I don't object to him being given bail, conditional bail. The judge goes, are you sure? And I said, he's got no previous convictions and never been involved in crime. Are you sure? Just like that, the way I'm saying it to you. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, absolutely. It says, and then I looked around, looked behind me. Guess it was a black person, right?
Now, how do you deal with that implicit racial bias?
Well, I'll tell you what I did in that particular situation. I stared at the judge. He has got no previous conviction. I said it like that. He got the point. Again, the way I dealt with it, and again, it has to be, there's no other way, there's no formal system, is that afterwards I had a conversation with the senior judge at that court and said, this is what happened. You need to make him aware of it. And you know what they did? They sent him on a training course. And, I don't know.
I'm sure that cured it,
of course, absolutely. but there's no other option and nothing else. Yeah, I don't know what you can do. Other than what I did with that other district judge, which is you complain performally and ultimately an investigation takes place and then that person is removed from the bench. That, I think, is one way of doing it. But people are scared. I mean, one of the things I've struck from this book is not just the law. In so many parts of British society, people are scared of speaking up because it'll affect their own careers.
That's so central to it. Let's talk about jury. Talk to me about
jury. Juries, there's the one problem with jury research is you can't do any jury research. juries are not allowed to talk about their cases, 1925 Act. And so you can't do any research. So it's all anecdotal. And what it suggests is that there are myths and stereotypes in the jury room. And we know this particularly around women, cases involving women and sexual abuse. And it's not to do with race, more to do with gender. That when you have a group of 12 people in the room, you'll get conversations happening about, for example, well, I don't believe a woman can be raped, you know, that kind of conversation. Well, you know, she could have said no. I don't know why it's taken so long, you know. So, yes, of course, myths. 12 ordinary members of the public, without any training, without any monitoring, without any education, are going to listen to the evidence and they will bring, and we ask them to bring your life experience into that room and make a judgment about who's telling the truth and who isn't telling the truth. And there will be, and again, anecdotally, I know this, and it's, again, I've covered it in part in the book, people have said, I was on a jury and there were clearly two guys in that room who didn't care what the evidence was. They'd already made up their mind. He's charged with an offensive face and being a black person, he must be guilty. End of the story. And I said, well, what do you do? I said, well, no, what can we do? At the end of the day, we acquitted him 10-2. you know, because you have 12 jury members. I thought that's, you know, that was just lucky there wasn't three, you know? And so 100% we have an issue here. And I think, again, a way to deal with that is we have questionnaires in some cases. You know, juries are asked questions before they're selected, usually high-profile cases. But we could do a little bit more. You know, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't know if you've got experience with this, but, you know, there are certain questions you can ask which can uncover those kinds of inherent biases that you referred to. And then if they have them, you say, well, thank you very much indeed, but we'll excuse you. Problem, again, is that we struggle with getting 12 people on a jury. People always find a way, don't they, Martin, to get off a jury when they when they're invited to join it. So from their perspective, there's no incentive really for them to say to a jury member, I'm sorry, we don't need you, because they actually desperately need them.
And what do you think about communities? So, and I talk communities in terms of areas of the country. So if you live in Toxteth or an area in central London, you might be very dominated by Black, Asian ethnic communities. But whereas if you live perhaps in Surrey or Hampshire, you might not, and those people may not be in your community.
Yeah.
That surely has an impact in racial bias.
Yeah, undoubtedly so. I mean, it's about who you know and what you know. If the only thing, and the media in some respects are culpable here, if the only description or portrayal of a Black person that you see on television is the killer, the thief, whatever, then that's going to impact on when you actually see a real one. You know, and I think there's no doubt about that.
Has research been done? That's quite interesting. I wonder what research has been done around television programs and films to show whether that bias comes out through the screen.
Well, yeah, I don't think it has been directly. It has, but we've talked before about the CSI effect, that when people see on TV somebody being caught on Deaf in Paradise using a bit of DNA and something, when they're in a courtroom or dealing with it, they immediately assume that evidence should be available, you know. So yes, clearly, I mean, we've all been brought up that way, you know. We all seem to think that what we see on TV must be like real life, and it goes back to the point, unless we educate people properly, unless we have proper conversations about this all the time, then those myths, those stereotypes, those inherent biases will impact on decisions that have enormous consequence. And in America, it's worse, isn't it? You hear about all these people that have spent 35 years in prison for stealing a loaf of bread or something, you know, because those biases are so deep. And with the civil rights movement and with slave trade and everything else, you can imagine how deep they are. But we're not immune here, I'm afraid, in this country. And by talking about it, as we are doing and as the book does, I hope that people are able to have a proper conversation about, because there are some answers, but I need to hear more answers. You know, where you just identified a moment ago, where's the research in this area or that area? Somebody needs to conduct that.
And what about, I'm interested, Archbishop of Canterbury, the Most Reverend Justin Welby, you spoke to him recently.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to Lambeth Palace.
What is he for you? Very nice.
He's happy to be called Woke Welby. Woke Welby. he gets called that all the time by certain national newspapers. He struck me as somebody who's genuine in tackling these issues.
Because acknowledges
100% he does. And he obviously, being a theologian, has religious basis for what he believes. You know, man is made in the image of God. We're all the same. There shouldn't be any reason to discriminate. You know, that is his basis for what he believes. Of course, the other side of that, because there was an American evangelical movement, think a different approach, don't they? So strange how religion can be misinterpreted or reinterpreted. He read to me, and I'll read it to you, something from Colossians 1:16. And this is what it says. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That, to him, is why he believes there can never be any excuse to treat people differently. You know, we are all born of the same God, however you want to put it. And he recognized within the church there were some significant issues. You know, there are, until recently, when the Archbishop of York was John Santanu, there haven't been any senior black leaders. There are loads of, going back to your point about rurality, there are loads of parts of this country where the local village, town, would not take kindly to a black vicar coming along. It's almost like Vicar of Dibley, but yeah, with the black version. And he was so he understood and recognizes, but not only that, he's trying to do something about it.
You know, yeah, I mean that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, Corinthians may say that, but if, and I don't want this to become a religious show, but yeah, you look at the church in itself, the church is not all accepting.
No,
of everybody, whether you have a ethnic origin or whether you have a different sexual bias from what the church would want you to be.
Yeah, absolutely accepts that, and he understands that. And as the leader of the Anglican Church, with you know with how many hundreds of millions of followers, he recognizes his responsibility. And I was really impressed with him. I don't know whether or not he can bring the change. What can one person do? But he's adamant that there is no place for it, certainly not in the church, and most definitely not in society. And he's, as I said, he's more than happy to take the brickbats that are thrown at him. But again, you know, there are others that are less impressive. I won't name them. You can read the book for that. Individuals who don't think there's a problem because they've never seen it themselves, or I hate to use this phrase, they collaborate with racists. You know,
so come on, give us a clue. Give us a clue. Come on, Lizzie.
I've got to leave some mystery, otherwise you're not going to pay $14.99, whatever it is.
But who else did you talk to?
The Mayor of London. I've spoken to Sanjeev Bhaskar, you know very well. Sanjeev told me a really good story, actually. He was applying for a job where he was playing an Indian. He's an actor of many years, 30 years standing. He was playing an Indian, and the director said to him, Sanjeev, your Indian accent isn't good enough. And Sanjeev goes, I'm fucking Indian. Right. What do you expect? What do you expect? And so the point is that some people think they know better, and I think that's his description of it. Sports are an area where I know you're very keen on sport, and
yes,
I not only do I speak to people in cricket, because cricket's really under attack, quite rightly so, for some of the racism that
bias that existed within the cricket fraternity,
Yorkshire, Scotland, you name it, and Middlesex as well. But other sports, tennis, which is, I know, is one of your favorite sports, I think. There are issues there. But, you know, for example, one of our strongest players is a young man called Draper. And he's well regarded. I think he's in the top 100 or something. And again, he often painted an example of how we people can succeed. The term meritocracy, you can succeed by working hard. And then you tend to forget that he's the son of the former head of the Lawn Tennis Association. You know, that privilege.
I think that's Jack Draper, number 55 in the world. He is, of course, Roger Draper's son. Roger Draper.
That's the point. He's a privilege. There are some sports in where we think, football's a good example where if you're good, you're good. You get to play. But tennis, you need proper coaching from an early age. We're not so good. Look at what Venus and Serena were able to do across the pond. We're not so good at finding young black boys and girls.
But that's about... tennis is very much a middle class community sport. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem
we can't differentiate class with race. Class and race go hand in hand, and you're absolutely spot on with that. Similarly, rowing. When's the last time you saw a black rower? By the way,
Where does rowing get taught? Rowing gets taught in private schools. In private clubs, of which you have to have funding to be able to do. This is why, when you look at sport and you see that interlinking between races and sport, that's why football does really well. Because actually, in terms of football, all you need is a couple of jumpers for your goals and a football. Whereas, with lots of the other things, you need the extra thing, which is going to cost you.
Exactly that. Other examples. I looked at yours, but it's also important to look at the leadership of these organisations. Archery GB, the Royal Yachting Association, British Golf, British Ice Skating, none of them have got anybody that's not white on their boards. So their boards are entirely white. British gymnastics, which apparently we're very good at these days. We are very good at it worldwide. We had Lewis Smith? I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
And but again, no diverse leadership. British cycling. In fact, recently I was shocked to see we had a black British cyclist at the Commonwealth Games. Where have they been? So you're right about the resources you need for rowing, but for cycling, do you really need anything more than a bike?
but you need a quality bike, and again, it's cost. And I think what the problem of a lot of these things is they become middle class sports for a lot of these things. And that's when it then ties into the race element of it.
But it has massive consequences. I mean, swim England. I spoke to Swim England. Yeah. Only 2% of regular swimmers are black. 80% of black children do not go swimming at all. Right now,
and why is that? Why is that? What is the lead for that? Is it because they can't afford to go? Is it because they're not being offered it within their community? Is it they feel isolated? Do they feel ostracized, perhaps from a community that might just be white predominant?
All of those. There's a real dearth of swimming pools these days, isn't there? We've closed so many now, so they don't tend to be. So if you imagine living in a city, they've closed the swimming pool down to build a block of flats. So the resources aren't there, and I'm pretty rubbish at swimming, but largely because I didn't have a swimming pool nearby, and so that doesn't exist. So it wasn't taught at school. It isn't taught at school so much these days. And of course, it's really dangerous, particularly right now with temperatures soaring as they have been. You end up going to the swimming pool or to the beach or something. So race has so many impacts in so many ways. And I'm literally scratched the surface with this book. I'm talking to some film companies about doing something more detailed for them about it. But the point being, it's deep in so many parts of our society, despite the journey that we've been on. Let's be positive. We've got some massive success stories, but we could have so many more. And if we're trying to make Britain, as we need to be, greater than we have been because of all the issues that we're facing, then we need to rely and tap into all the potential and not just a select group.
And I want to just look at two further areas. So I want to look at politics and industry. So let's start with politics. What was the impact in politics?
I've interviewed a number of people, including the Mayor of London. The Mayor of London, if you remember, Sadiq Khan was the first Muslim mayor of any major city in the world. The campaign to when he was elected was inherently racist, run by Zach Goldsmith and others. He's still the only mayor, I think, in Europe that has to, because of threats that have been made to him, has to have security detail. So he can't get on, unlike Boris Johnson when he was mayor, where he just get on a bike and go somewhere. Sadiq and his family have to be escorted everywhere they go. And that's an impact. A former leader of a council, Asian leader of council, had her car firebombed, so there are plenty of examples of that. And I think politics should be, you look at the senior leadership now of the Conservative Party and you think, oh my God, we've achieved everything. But it goes back to what I said right at the beginning. It's despite the racism that you get to where you want to get to. And the moment you fail, look at what happened to Rishi Sunak, the amount of abuse he got and continues to get, the amount of abuse Sajid Javid got. The moment you fail, the racists come out. Right now, they'll celebrate you and, well done, well done, well done. The moment that they see an excuse and a reason to have a go at you, they won't just have a go at you because of your failure, they'll have a go at you also because of your color of your skin.
And industry?
Yeah, some positives here, but not necessarily in this country. I mean, if you think about it, the leader of Google, the leader of Twitter, the leader of Microsoft, the leader of many of these organizations are Indians, CEOs of all of these institutions. But that's not the case in this country. That said, and this might shock a lot of people because people have a view of the private sector as opposed to, they seem to think the public sector must be much more diverse and better at it. Actually, the private sector, because it's run by money, at the end of the day, they don't care. They don't really care what color you are as long as you're making money for the organization. So actually, I found less racism at senior leadership level in business than I did.
What about racial bias to get the job in the first place?
Again, money talks. Extreme wealth tends to be an immunity. I might hate you because of the color of your skin, but you're going to help our bottom line. Nobody's business, you know. And so, therefore, I will recruit this person. So they'll dampen down their racism, because at the end of the day, money, the color of money, outdoes the color of your skin. There's a good phrase somewhere. I should have put that in the book.
I didn't. So tell us, the book will now be out by
HarperCollins. HarperCollins. It's called The Race to the Top, and available anywhere you want to get it. And there's also an audio version. If you want to listen to 8 hours of me reading it to you, go and find the audio version. It's really important to me that even if you can't buy it, please go to a library or something, because we need to generate some solutions, not just the problems.
Before we move on to the final element, one of the things I want to ask you about is, you made a tweet this week about the new Home Secretary. Fan?
No. I think my tweet was, I think we're ready for the asteroid. Because I've dealt with so many attorney generals, and she was the attorney general. And I can assure you, Mark, she was, and it was, the worst attorney general in my lifetime. And I've dealt with 8 or 9, I think. And that doesn't get any better by being Home Secretary. You know, let's be open-minded. Maybe she's seen the light. I'm not entirely sure of that. But as I said, we're in quite a bad place when people are appointed through loyalty rather than talent. You know, you know what was going on there. She stood to be leader. She stepped down, then supports the current prime minister. And then all these deals happening left, right and center. What we need is really competent, the best people in our leadership roles. And I'm not persuaded that she is.
So, Nazir, your book is out. I think it's fascinating. I think it's one of those areas we've still got so much work to do. And we've talked a lot about misogyny, which still exists in the police service. There's no doubt that racism exists within the police service in its many different disguises. And I think it's great that you've spoken to these different individuals, and that hopefully that will encourage them to keep making change, because all we can do is keep talking about it. And as a result of keep talking about it, hopefully change will come.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Fear or Favour. We are now fortnightly. Please do continue to send us your emails, correspondence, tweet us, tell us what you think about the podcast, and certainly ask us about any specific cases or areas that you would like us to discuss. Until a fortnight's time, look after yourself and take care. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.